Sounds True presents After the Ecstasy, The Laundry, an original author adaptation with writer, clinical psychologist, and meditation instructor, Jack Kornfield.
An opening bow. When I found myself becoming a Buddhist monk in a forest monastery of Thailand over 30 years ago, I had to learn how to bow. It was awkward at first. Each time we entered the meditation hall, we would drop to our knees and three times respectfully place our head between our palms on the stone floor. It was a practice of reverence and mindfulness, a way of honoring with a bodily gesture our commitment to the monk's path of simplicity, compassion, and awareness. We would bow in the same way each time we took our seat for training with the master. After I'd been in the monastery for a week or two, one of the senior monks pulled me aside for further instruction. In this monastery, you must not only bow when entering the meditation hall and receiving teachings from the master, but also when you meet your elders. As the only Westerner and wanting to act correctly, I asked, "Who were my elders?" It is traditional that all who are older in ordination time, who've been monks longer than you, are your elders, I was told. It took only a moment to realize that meant everybody. So I began to bow to them. Sometimes it was just fine. There were quite a few wise and worthy elders in the community. But sometimes it felt ridiculous. I would encounter some 21-year-old monk full of hubris who was there only to please his parents or eat better food than he could at home, and I had to bow because he'd been ordained the week before me. Or I had to bow to some sloppy old rice farmer who'd come to the monastery the season before on the farmer's retirement plan, who chewed betel nut constantly and never meditated a day in his life. It was hard to pay reverence to these fellow forest dwellers as if they were the great masters. Yet there I was bowing, and because I was in conflict, I sought a way to make it work. Finally, as I prepared yet again for a day of bowing to my elders, I began to look for some worthy aspect of each person I bowed to. I bowed to the wrinkles around the retired farmer's eyes, for all the difficulties he'd seen and suffered through and triumphed over. I bowed to the vitality, playfulness in the young monks, the incredible possibilities each of their lives held yet ahead of them. I began to enjoy bowing. I bowed to my elders. I bowed before I entered the dining hall and as I left. I bowed as I entered my forest hut, and I bowed at the well before taking a bath. After some time, bowing became my way. It was just what I did. If it moved, I bowed to it. It is the spirit of bowing that informs this book. The true task of spiritual life is not found in faraway places or unusual states of consciousness. It is here in the present. It asks of us a welcoming spirit to greet all that life presents to us with a wise, respectful, and kindly heart. We can bow to both beauty and suffering, to our entanglements and confusion, to our fears, and to the injustices of the world. Honoring the truth in this way is the path to freedom. To bow to what is, rather than to some ideal, is not necessarily easy. But however difficult, it is one of the most useful and honorable practices. To bow to the fact of our life's sorrows and betrayals is to accept them, and from this deep gesture, we discover that all life is workable. As we learn to bow, we discover that the heart holds more freedom and compassion than we could imagine. The Persian poet Rumi speaks of it this way: "This being human is a guest house, every morning a new arrival, a joy, a meanness, a depression, some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond." Introduction, some honest questions. When the bird and the book disagree, always believe the bird, said James Audubon. Enlightenment does exist. It is possible to awaken. Unbounded freedom and joy, oneness with the divine, awakening into a state of timeless grace, these experiences are more common than you know and not far away. There is one further truth, however. They don't last. Our realizations and awakenings show us the reality of the world, and they bring transformation, but they pass. Of course, you may have read traditional accounts of fully enlightened sages in Asia, or of holy, unblemished saints and mystics in the West. But these ideal narratives can be misleading. In fact, in the awakening of the heart, there is no such thing as enlightened retirement. That is not how it happens to us. We all know that after the honeymoon comes the marriage. After the election comes the hard task of governance. In spiritual life, it is the same. After the ecstasy comes the laundry. Most spiritual accounts end with illumination or enlightenment. But what if we ask, what happens after that? What happens when the Zen master returns home to spouse and children? What happens when the Christian mystic goes shopping? What is life like after the ecstasy? How do we live our understanding with a full heart? To explore these questions, I've spoken with a number of people who have dedicated 25, 35, 40 years to a spiritual path, especially those who've become the Western meditation masters and abbots, the Western teachers and lamas of our generation. They told me of their initial journeys and awakenings, and then described the lessons of the years that followed as they have sought to fulfill the true path of compassion on this earth. Here's one account of a Western Zen master's initial satori or enlightenment experience and its aftermath. Such accounts are rarely made public because of the danger that they will give the wrong impression that those who experience such an awakening are somehow special. Although the experience is special, it does not happen to a special person. It happens to any one of us when the conditions of letting go and opening the heart are present, when we can sense the world in a radically new way. For this teacher, awakening came at age 58, after many years of practice with several meditation masters, while at the same time he was developing a career and raising a family. The week-long meditation of a Zen Sesshin was always very intense for me. I would feel a deep emotional release, and strong memories would come up as if I were in a birth process, strong pains and physical catharsis. These would carry over for weeks when I went back home. This Sesshin began the same way. During the first days, I struggled with powerful emotions and the release of energy coursing through my body. And each time I saw the master, he would sit there like a rock, his presence steadying me like a rudder in dark, turbulent seas. I felt as if I was dying or breaking apart. He urged me to sink into my koan, to let myself go completely into it. I couldn't tell where my life began or left off. Then, a surprising sweetness began to seep in. I saw three young birch trees out the window, and they were like my family. I could feel myself go and stroke their smooth bark, and I became the tree touching myself, my meditation filled with light. I'd felt bliss before, big waves of it on some retreats after my body pains opened up, but this was different. All struggle stopped, and my mind became luminous, radiant, vast as the sky, and filled with the most delicious scent of freedom of awakening. I felt like the Buddha, sitting effortlessly hour after hour, held and protected by the whole universe. I lived in a world of unending peace and unspeakable joy. The great truths of life were so clear, the way grasping is the cause of suffering, that by following the small sense of self, this false ego, We run around like the petty landlord, squabbling over nothing. I wept at all our unnecessary sorrows. And then for hours, I could not stop smiling and laughing. I saw how perfect it all is, how every single moment is enlightenment if only we open to it. For days I rested in this timeless, utter peace, my body floating, my mind empty. I would wake up and waves of love and joyful energy would stream through my consciousness. Then, insights and revelations came one after another. I saw how the stream of life unfolds in patterns that we create as the flow of our karma. I saw the whole idea of spiritual renunciation as a kind of a joke, trying to make oneself let go of ordinary life and pleasures. In fact, nirvana is so open and joyful, is so much more than all of the small pleasures we grasp after. You don't renounce the world, you gain the world. The description of a great awakening like this usually appears at the end of a spiritual story. Enlightenment comes, the person enters the stream of wise beings, and everything follows naturally after that. In essence, we are left with the impression that the awakened person lives happily ever after. But what happens if we stay with this story and ask to hear further chapters? Some months after all this ecstasy came a depression, along with some significant betrayals in my work. I had continuing trouble with my children and family, too. Oh, my teaching was fine. I could give inspired lectures, but if you talk to my wife, she'll tell you that as the time passed, I became as grouchy and impatient as ever. I knew this great spiritual vision was the truth, and it was there underneath, but I also recognized how many things didn't change at all. To be honest, my mind and personality were pretty much the same, and my neuroses, too. Perhaps it's worse, because now I see them more clearly. Here were these cosmic revelations, and I still needed therapy just to sort through the day-to-day mistakes and lessons of living a human life. What are we to make of an account of awakening like this one and the story that follows? It offers us a mirror for self-understanding. Sacred traditions have always been carried in great measure by storytelling. We tell and retell the story of Noah, the Baal Shem Tov, Muhammad, Saint Teresa, Milarepa, Krishna and Arjuna, the Buddha's search, the stories of Jesus. And in modern times, we learn from the lives of Thomas Merton, Suzuki Roshi, Anne Frank, and Martin Luther King Jr. Through other spiritual lives, we can see our own possibilities and better understand how to live wisely. People watching is also in my lineage. My teacher Ajahn Chah knew that through our character is found both our suffering and our liberation. So he would peer at those who came to see him like a watchmaker taking off the case of a watch to see how it ticks. By good fortune, as a spiritual, quote, professional, unquote, circumstances have given me close contact with many figures in modern spiritual life. I have lived and taught with holy nuns and wise abbots of Christian monasteries, with Jewish mystics, with Hindu, Sufi, and Buddhist masters, and with leading figures of the Jungian and transpersonal communities. What one can observe and hear in such company reveals much about the way the modern spiritual journey unfolds and the difficulties even the most dedicated people encounter. Here's an example of what one might learn in such company. Since the early 1990s, I've been involved in convening a succession of gatherings for Buddhist teachers from all the great schools. One series was hosted by the Dalai Lama at his Dharamsala Palace. Here, Western and Asian teachers gathered to discuss the ways Buddhist practice might be of help in the modern world, and also to address the difficulties we encountered. It was a room full of good-hearted, compassionate Zen masters, lamas, monks, and meditation masters, whose wisdom, work, and communities had brought benefit to thousands. We talked about many successes and our joy in being part of them. But when the time came to talk honestly about our problems, It grew clear that spiritual life was not entirely harmonious. It reflected our collective struggles and individual neurosis as well. Even among such an august and dedicated company, there were major areas of prejudice and blindness. Sylvia Wetzel, a Buddhist teacher from Germany, talked about how hard it was for women and feminine wisdom to be fully included in the Buddhist community. She pointed to the many golden Buddhas and exquisite Tibetan paintings surrounding our room, noting they were all depicted as male. Then she instructed the Dalai Lama and the other lamas and masters to close their eyes and meditate with her, to imagine they were entering the room and that it had been transformed so that they bowed to the 14th female incarnation of the Dalai Lama. And with her were many advisors who had always been female, and surrounding them were images of Buddhas and saints, all naturally in women's bodies. Of course, it is never taught that there's anything lesser about being a man. Despite that, these men are asked to sit in the back, be silent, and after the meeting to help with the cooking. At the end of her meditation, the eyes of every man in the room reopened, slightly astonished. Then, Ani Tenzin Palmo, a Tibetan nun of English descent, who had trained for 20 years, 12 of them in caves on the Tibetan border, spoke, in a gentle voice, describing the spiritual longing and incredible hardships of devoted women, who were allowed to live only at the periphery of the monasteries, often without teaching, food, or support. And when she finished, the Dalai Lama put his head in his hands and wept. He pledged his best support to revising the place of women in his community to one of more equality. And yet, in the years since, many senior teachers in every Buddhist country have continued to resist and struggle against these changes, sometimes in the name of tradition, at other times because of the psychological and cultural conditioning. At the meeting with the Dalai Lama, one senior Zen abbot admitted that his painful relationship with his mother made it nearly impossible for him to guide the group of women who had become priests in his temple. Others admitted their own struggles in this area. Our conversation turned to other forms of blindness. Sectarianism and destructive power struggles between certain Buddhist masters and communities, the isolation and loneliness of the role of the teacher, the teachers who may in turn have exploited their students through misuse of power, money, and sexuality. In informal discussions, we spoke also of more personal problems. Teachers described painful divorces, periods of fear and depression, conflicts with family or other community members. Meditation teachers told of stress and illness, of teenage children threatening suicide, or belligerent teens wanting to stay out all night who confront their parents with, "You're a Zen master and look how attached you are." We all have the problems that come with bodies, personalities, family, and community. We saw our common humanity. Fortunately, we also shared the astonishing gifts that spiritual practice had given us. The joy and freedom that we carry with us in the difficult and changing circumstances of the world. What was remarkable and new was the honesty with which we spoke. Our intention was inspired by the humility and compassion of the Dalai Lama himself, always eager to learn, even from his mistakes. We began to see that we could learn from one another, find ways to avoid recreating painful mistakes, to allow our ideals to embrace our humanness. It was as if the flowering of individual wisdom and learning came more fully alive as a collective, as a whole. The difficulties of finding a wise expression of spiritual life in modern circumstances are not limited to Eastern traditions. One Mother Superior, the beloved abbess of a century-old Catholic nunnery in Maine, grew up in the silences of her cloister from age 17 until the 1960s. Then, Pope John XXIII, in the spirit of reform, changed the Mass from Latin to English and opened the strict silence of the monastic orders. This was incredibly hard for those who'd been sheltered in holy silence for decades, their days filled with prayer and inner reflection. They simply didn't know how to talk, and when they did, what emerged was sometimes surprisingly conflicted. Along with their love came out many hidden judgments, built-up resentments, pettiness, and fears that had been kept hidden within the container of prayer and silence. The sisters were forced to grapple with their spiritual life out loud, without any prior training in wise speech. Many fled the convent. It took some years for the community to find the same grace in human words they had felt in silence. Yet spiritual life needs both. As much as our breath comes in and out, it must integrate inner knowing and outer expression. It is not enough to touch awakening. We must find ways to live its vision fully. Perfect enlightenment appears in many texts, but amid all the Western masters and teachers I know, such utter perfection is not apparent. Times of wisdom, deep compassion, and a real knowing of freedom alternate with periods of fear, confusion, neurosis, and struggle. Most teachers will readily admit this truth. Unfortunately, a few Westerners have claimed to achieve a perfection and freedom with no shadow. Among their communities, things are worse. By their self-inflation, they have often created the most power-centered and destructive communities among us. The wisest express a greater humility, abbots like Father Thomas Keating of Snowmass Monastery, and Norman Fisher of San Francisco Zen Center, for example, regularly say, "I'm learning and I don't know." In the spirit of Gandhi, Mother Teresa, Dorothy Day, and the Dalai Lama, they understand that spiritual perfection is not born of oneself, but of patience and love that grow through the wisdom of the larger community, that spiritual fulfillment and freedom include a compassion for all that arises in this human form. One might ask at this point, what about the old masters in Asia? Might it not be that Western Zen masters and lamas are simply too young and undeveloped to represent real enlightenment? Many Western teachers would agree that this is true of themselves. But while there might be someone far away who appears to fit the image of perfect enlightenment, that appearance may result from a confusion between the archetypal and the human levels. In Tibet, there's a saying that your guru should live at least three valleys away. These valleys are separated by huge mountains, so to see your teacher means many days of hard travel. The point is that only at this distance can you be inspired by the perfection of the guru. When I complained to my abbot, Ajahn Chah, considered by millions to be a great saint, that he didn't always act as if he were completely enlightened, he laughed and told me that was good, because otherwise you'd still be imagining you could find the Buddha outside of yourself. And he is not out here. Indeed, many of the most appealing and highly regarded Asian masters have spoken about still being students themselves, always learning from mistakes. Some, like Zen Master Shunryu Suzuki, did not even claim enlightenment. Instead, Suzuki Roshi said, strictly speaking, there are no enlightened people, there is only enlightened activity. This remarkable statement tells us that enlightenment cannot be held by anyone. It simply exists in moments of freedom. Pir Vilayat Khan, the 75-year-old head of the Sufi order in the West, confides his own belief. Of so many great teachers I've met in India and Asia, if you were to bring them to America, get them a house, two cars, a spouse, three kids, a job, insurance, and taxes, they would all have a hard time. Whatever our initial vision of spiritual life, to be authentic, it must be fulfilled here and now in the place where we live. What does a Westerner's journey look like in the midst of a complex society? How have those who've devoted 25, 30, 40 years to spiritual life learned to live? These are the questions I began to ask of those who've become the Western Zen masters, lamas, rabbis, abbots, nuns, yogis, teachers, and their most senior students. To understand spiritual life, I started at the beginning, I asked what draws us to the life of the Spirit, and what difficulties we have to pass through on our way. I asked what gifts and awakenings have come, and what we can know about enlightenment. And then I asked what happens after the ecstasy, as we mature in the cycles of spiritual life. Is there a wisdom which includes both the ecstasy and the laundry? Part 1. Preparation for Ecstasy, Baba Yaga and Our Sacred Longing. The moment I heard my first story, I started looking for you, says Rumi. What is it that draws a person to spiritual life? From as far back as we can remember, we can each sense a mystery in being alive. When we're present with an infant in the first moments after birth, or when the death of a loved one brushes close to us, the mystery becomes tangible. It is there when we witness a radiant sunset or find a moment's silent stillness in the flowing season of our days. Connecting to the sacred is perhaps our deepest need and longing. Awakening calls to us in a thousand ways. As the poet Rumi sings, grapes want to turn to wine. There is a pull to wholeness, to being fully alive, even when we've forgotten. The Hindus tell us that the child in the womb sings, do not let me forget who I am. But the song after birth becomes, oh, I've forgotten already. Still, as surely as there is a voyage away, there is a journey home. Throughout the world, we find stories of this journey, images of the longing to awaken, the steps along the path that we all follow, the voices that call, the intensity of the initiation we may meet, the courage we need. At the heart of each is the original sincerity of the seeker, who must honestly admit how small is our knowledge of the universe, how great the unknown. The honesty the spiritual quest requires of us is addressed in the Russian initiation tales about Baba Yaga. Baba Yaga is an old woman with a wild, hag-like visage who stirs her pot and knows all things. She lives deep in the forest. When we seek her out, we're frightened, for she requires us to go into the dark, to ask dangerous questions, to step outside the world of logic and comfort. When the first young seeker comes quaking up to the door of her hut, Baba Yaga demands, are you on your own errand, or are you sent by another? The young man, encouraged in his quest by his family, answered, I am sent by my father. Baba Yaga promptly throws him into the pot and cooks him. The next to attempt this quest, the young woman, sees the smoldering fire and hears the cackle of Baba Yaga. Baba Yaga demands again, are you on your own errand or are you sent by another? This young woman has been pulled into the woods alone to seek what she can find there. I'm on my own errand, she replies. Baba Yaga throws her in the pot and cooks her too. Later, a third visitor, again a young woman, deeply confused by the world, comes to Baba Yaga's house far into the forest. She sees the smoke and knows it's dangerous. Baba Yaga confronts her. Are you on your own errand, or are you sent by another? This young woman answers truthfully, in large part, I'm on my own errand, but in large part, I've also come because of others. And in large part, I've come because you are here, and because of the forest, and something I've forgotten, and in large part, I know not why I come. Baba Yaga regards her for a moment and says, you'll do, and shows her into the hut. Into the woods. Midway along our road of life, I woke to find myself standing alone in a dark wood, said Dante Alighieri. We don't know all the reasons that propel us on a spiritual journey, but somehow our life compels us to go. Something in us knows that we are not just here to toil at our work. There's a mysterious pull to remember. What takes us out of our homes and into the dark of Baba Yaga's forest can be a combination of events. It can be a longing from childhood, an accidental encounter with a spiritual figure or book. Sometimes something in us awakens when we travel to a foreign culture and the exotic world of new rhythms, fragrant smells, colors, and activity catapults us out of our usual sense of reality. Sometimes It's as simple as walking in the blue-green mountains or hearing choral music so beautiful it seems inspired by the gods. Sometimes it's that mysterious transformation when we attend at the bedside of the dying and a person vanishes from existence, leaving only a lifeless sack of flesh awaiting burial. 1,000 gates open to the spirit, whether in the brilliance of beauty or the dark woods of confusion and sorrow, a force as sure as gravity brings us back to our heart. It happens to every one of us. The Messengers of Suffering. The most frequent entryway to the sacred is our own suffering and dissatisfaction. Countless spiritual journeys have begun in an encounter with the difficulties of life. For Western masters, suffering in early family life is a common start. Alcoholic or abusive parents, grave family illness, loss of a loved relative, or cold absentee parents and warring family members all recur in many of their stories. For one wise and respected meditation master, it started with isolation and disconnection, he said. When I was a child, our family life had so much unhappiness. Everyone was yelling. I felt like I didn't belong there. I felt like an alien. Then, about age 9, I became really interested in flying saucers. For years at night, I would fantasize that a UFO was going to pick me up, that I'd be abducted, taken back to another planet. I really wanted that, to escape from my alienation and loneliness. I guess that was the beginning of my 4 decades of spiritual search. We all know how much the heart longs for spiritual sustenance in times of difficulty. Honor this longing, says Rumi. Those that make you return, for whatever reason, to the spirit, be grateful to them. Worry about the others who give you delicious comfort that keep you from your prayer. Crisis is an invitation to the spirit, not only in childhood, but whenever our life passes through suffering. For many masters, the gateway to the spiritual opened when loss or desperation, suffering or confusion drove them to look for solace of the heart, for a hidden wholeness. The long journey of one teacher began in adulthood, overseas. I was in Hong Kong. My marriage was going badly. My youngest daughter had died from sudden infant death syndrome 2 years earlier, and in every way I was not happy. We returned to America, and at Stanford Business School, I saw a sign for Tai Chi and signed up. That began to calm my body, but my heart remained sorrowful and confused. I separated from my wife and tried various forms of meditation to calm myself. Then a girlfriend introduced me to her meditation master, who invited me to a retreat. The room was formal and silent as we sat hour after hour. On the second morning, suddenly, I saw myself standing looking at my daughter's grave, with a shovelful of red earth being thrown on it. Tears came and a wail rose from me. The other students nearby hissed and whispered, "Shut up," but the master came over and told them to be still and held me for a time. And I wept and blubbered, filled with grief all morning, and that was how it began. And now, 30 years later, I'm the one holding those who weep. The encounter with suffering that leads us to seek an answer is a universal story. In the life story of the Buddha as Prince Siddhartha, the Buddha-to-be was deliberately protected from the problems of the world by his father, sequestered in beautiful palaces during his early years. Finally, the young prince insisted on going out to see the world. As he rode through the kingdom with his charioteer Channa, he saw 4 sights which stunned him deeply. First, the Buddha saw a very old person, tottering, bent over, and frail. Next, he saw a man grievously ill, cared for by his friends. Then he saw a dead body. Each time, he asked his charioteer, "To whom do these things happen?" Each time, Channa replied, "To everyone, my lord." These sights are called the heavenly messengers, for just as they awaken the Buddha, so they remind us all to seek liberation, to seek a spiritual freedom in this life. Can you remember the first time you saw a dead body or a person gravely ill? This first up-close encounter with sickness and death sent a shock through Siddhartha's whole being. How can we best live in a life haunted by illness and death, he wondered. The fourth messenger came when he saw a monk standing at the edge of the forest, a hermit who had devoted a life of simplicity to seek an end to the sorrows of the world. At this sight, the Buddha realized he too must follow this path, that he must face directly the sorrows of life and attempt to find a way beyond their grasp. The heavenly messengers come in some form to each of us, calling us to seek a wholeness missing in our lives. They come not just as our own struggles, but in the sorrows of the world. These have such a powerful effect on our hearts that any day's news could break them open. The perennial floods of Bangladesh, the hunger and warfare of Africa, of Europe and Asia, the ecological crises worldwide, the racism, poverty, and violence of our cities. They too are the messengers. They are a call. As they did for the Buddha, they demand that we awaken. Return to innocence. Lest it all sound difficult, there is another side to the forces that draw so many of us into the woods. A beauty calls to us, a wholeness that we know exists. The Sufis call this the voice of the beloved. We are born into this world with this song in our ears, yet we may first come to know it by its absence. When we live without connectedness, without an illumination of spirit, we can feel in ourselves the deep longing of a lost child, a subtle longing as though we know something essential is missing, something that dances at the edge of our vision, always with us, like the air we forget until the wind blows. Yet it is this elusive spirit which holds us completely, which nourishes the heart, summoning us toward our search for what life is all about. We are pulled to return to our own true nature, to our wise and knowing heart. This sacred longing can arise first in childhood, as it did for the Zen master of a large European community. I remember as a child having experiences of wonder and identity with the world. I felt an identity with the hills, seeing them dance and the rivers in between, and one day I imagined myself part of a great summer storm that swept through our town. At about 12, I recognized how incredible the game of life is, how much bigger than anything I knew. Then I'd forget and go back to playing soccer and playing with friends until the next time it happened, another moment of this naive, sweet opening. Later, I heard an Indian Swami talk at the university about the world of nature and mystery, and he wept quite openly. I was so touched, as if I was hearing Jesus talk, and I began to remember again that innocent connection to my childhood. When you realize how much you've lost, you have to go looking again for those moments when your spirit first came alive. Over the years, a practical and materialistic society can usurp the original mystery of childhood. We are sent to school early to grow up, to be serious, and if we don't let go of our childhood innocence, all too often the world tries to knock it out of us. 100 years ago, the American painter James McNeill Whistler encountered this attitude in his engineering class at West Point Military Academy. The students were instructed to draw a careful study of a bridge, and Whistler submitted a beautiful, detailed, picturesque stone arch with children fishing from its top. The lieutenant in charge ordered, "This is a military exercise. Get those children off the bridge." Whistler resubmitted the drawing with the two children now fishing from the side of the river. "I said get those children completely out of the picture," said the angry lieutenant. So Whistler's last version had the river, the bridge, and two small tombstones along its bank. As the existentialist writer Albert Camus discovered, a man's life is nothing but an extended trek through the detours of art to recapture those one or two moments when his heart first opened. The Zen tradition describes this journey in its account of the sacred ox. In ancient India, oxen were a symbol for the wondrous and powerful qualities that reside within every being, that awaken as we discover our true nature. The Zen ox-herding story begins with a scroll painting of a man wandering into the mountain thickets. The image is entitled Seeking the Ox. Behind the man is a maze of crisscrossing roads, the old highways of ambition and fear, confusion and loss, praise and blame. For a long time, this man has forgotten the flowing rivers and mountain vistas, but on the day he finally remembers, he sets out seeking the tracks of the sacred ox. In his heart, he knows that even in the deepest gorges, in the topmost mountains, the ox cannot be lost. In the beauty of the forest, he stops to rest, and looking down, he sees the first tracks. The Sacred Question. The first sighting of the tracks of the ox is described by Joseph Campbell as a call to awakening, an inner pull. With it arises a sacred question. For each of us, this sacred question is different. Some of us struggle with pain. Others simply want to know how best to live. Some wonder what's important, what's the purpose of life. Others ask, how can we love, or who are we, how can we be free? Some of us ask the question as we hurry through our days, why such a rush? Some masters who are interviewed turn to philosophy to answer their questions. Others try the avenue of poetry and the arts. Sacred question is at the root of much poetry. Rhetoric is the argument you have with another, wrote Yeats, poetry with oneself. The call to the journey is like a half-formed poem awaiting completion. Kabir, the Indian mystic poet, asks, can you tell me who has built this house of ours, and where do you hurry to before your death? Can you find the thing of true value in this world? Whatever the source of this profound questioning, we must follow where it leads. A Washington, D.C. lawyer, brought up in a close-knit family, lived a traditional life until her outward success became difficult and empty. Then she began to question it all. I was the eldest child of six, who loved each other and went to Mass every day, attended Catholic girls' school all the way through college. As a girl, I prayed often and fervently. I offered things up for the souls in purgatory, made up various harmless rituals to remind myself of Jesus, how much he loved me. Then I got married. It was the tumultuous 60s, and I was already divorced by age 29. Having entered a bigger, wilder life, more frightening than I knew, I graduated UCLA Law School and several years of therapy at the same time. My 30s were hell, battling a prolonged deep depression with no idea of who I might be or what I might hope for from life. All I could do was throw myself into my work night and day, and in 10 years I was elected the first woman partner of the oldest law firm in Washington, D.C. at a ceremony at the Carlton Hotel Ballroom. This success was heady at first. It made up for other losses, but eventually the charm wore off, and my life seemed supremely selfish. With the rich getting richer and the poor sliding down the ladder, I realized I was part of the problem, and I wasn't even having fun doing it. Then two of my closest friends died. My mother was next. I resigned my partnership to care for her, and found that being present for her and my father through their shock and denial to acceptance was the most satisfying task of my life. I began volunteering at a hospice and started to meditate. Wrestling with the persistent devil of emptiness directly for the first time was like coming home. I would never have thought it possible, but now I feel most myself when sitting in silence, listening. And I found my heart again after all these years, and with a lot of help from friends, the courage to follow it. Calls from Beyond. Sometimes the opening of the mind and heart comes as if a call from the gods, a pull from outside our ordinary life. It is as if we are compelled to enter the forest, to search for Baba Yaga by forces quite beyond our knowing. In Rumi's poem of the guest house quoted earlier, he counsels us to be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. In the powerful shock of near-death experiences, thousands of Americans have had a spiritual opening. In Closer to the Light, Dr. Melvin Morse, a physician, documents children's near-death experiences. a child awakens from nearly drowning, and then going into a coma to tell her astonished doctor about a golden figure, an angel, who pulled her from under the dark water and brought her through a tunnel where she met her grandfather, who had died years before, and then the Heavenly Father himself. One after another, child's accounts speak of finding the light that makes us all, and the light that has everything good in it. After that, they say, you're not afraid to live through anything. A Sufi master speaks of the motorcycle accident that he had at age 19. I was on the critical list, with broken limbs and internal ruptures. As my mind cleared, I remembered that for a second after the impact, I was looking down at my body in the street from a short distance above. I could see, but my being was completely non-physical. It was peaceful and quiet. I was relieved. I knew that I had the option to return to my body or let go into this wonderful, peaceful darkness. But when I looked at the scene below, what arose was an intense feeling of love for this body and for life. Love and joy made me come back. They kept telling me that in the ambulance I was crying and laughing. I felt a reality of freedom that was beyond the physical, an intense joy and happiness that has motivated my spiritual life now for 35 years. I love this reality, and I have followed its call. Each call from beyond asks us to step outside of our ordinary sense of the world. For one teacher of Kundalini Yoga, the request came in the last stage of labor. My breathing became faster and faster. My body began shaking between the contractions, filled with radiant light. Not just my pelvis, but my heart, my head, every part of me was trying to open. I felt like my baby and I were expanding, containing all the energy of the world. Later, my doctor told me it frightened him. He tried to give me a tranquilizer to calm me down. My eyes were wide with wonder, but from that moment on, I wanted to bring that energy into my life. Although the materialistic and scientific world of our culture may try to hide us from the vast source of our life, it cannot be denied. Over and over, we hear tales, large and small, of the heart, the spirit, the soul reawakening to a greater vision of reality.